guys. Welcome back to the Thrillogy podcast. My name's Krista, and I'm here with my two co-hosts,
Morgan
and Cameron.
If you left a comment on our Instagram guessing the topic of this week's episode, be sure to listen until the end of the show for your shout out. And now, on to the episode. We are back this week with another unfortunate and frustrating case. To most, Hawaii seems like a paradise full of beaches and sunshine. But during January 1982, it was quite the opposite. Lisa Au was a 19-year-old hairstylist attending the University of Hawaii. On the night of January 20th, Lisa was finishing up an evening shift at the salon and was going to head to her boyfriend's sister's apartment in Makiki. Her grocery run beforehand and dinner in Makiki would be the last time that Lisa was seen alive. After the dinner, Lisa headed home to Kailua in a torrential downpour. But as all true crime stories begin, Lisa never made it home. When Lisa did not return home, her parents called her boyfriend Doug Holmes, who she was attending the University of Hawaii with, to see if he knew anything. But Holmes reported that the two ended the night and went out to their cars together, and he did not know Lisa's whereabouts from there. However, off the bat, Holmes agreed right away to begin looking for Au. Strangely enough, it was Holmes who found the vehicle on the side of the road and reported it to the police. The car was a 1976 Toyota Corolla and was found at Mauna Willi. Now, something that struck me as immediately odd was that her window was actually rolled down. And mind you, it was a torrential downpour rainstorm, so everything in the car was soaked, which we know as well could be devastating for any evidence. Even more strange, when they recovered her purse on the seat, the bag and its contents were completely dry. Now, I feel like we can all agree that in true crime stories and scenarios that when the soon-to-be victim leaves without their belongings, it's never a good sign. It was these signs that kicked the community into gear. Missing posters were distributed immediately, and her family was talking to the press, thanking everyone for their outstanding efforts in trying to locate their daughter. This is a case that could seem simple. A rainy night, a mother insisting her daughter don't head out in the storm, and even worse, she had just gotten her license. Could it have been a case of Lisa losing control in the rain and hurting herself? However, a case of inexperienced driving was not the issue. Tragically, 10 days later, a jogger discovered Lisa's body just a few miles from where the car was left. Her body was naked and already decomposing. In fact, her body was in such bad condition from the decomposition that the Honolulu medical examiner reported he could not even tell the cause of death. This is where we get into the theories more so and the witness accounts, and like I warned, it becomes frustrating. One of the witness accounts that stuck out to me, and I believe many others, is that Lisa's car was seen with blue flashing lights tailing her. This immediately threw the investigation and community into thinking that a police officer could be responsible, especially since her license had been missing from her belongings and purse. With the car having the window half rolled down, it's possible that Lisa felt as if she was being pulled over, and as a nervous new driver, that was understandable.
Could it also be, too, that maybe she thought it was a police officer, but maybe it was just somebody impersonating a police officer?
Right. So I kind of had the same debate with myself. Mm-hmm. And originally, Honolulu Police Department's policy was that unmarked cars could only pull over drivers when they had a uniformed officer with them. And in fact, multiple women in the following months had reported that they had been pulled over in similar circumstances.
So can I ask, who saw the blue lights trailing her? Like, did they have any input on if it was a marked car or anything like that?
Well, we are going to get to the witness account of, like, kind of when they were driving around. But again, that's going to become one of the frustrated points that you see, because right now it seems like, oh, this is the only information that they collected. But we actually find out that the witness wound up seeing not a lot more, but the police could have interviewed this witness more. So stay tuned. The flashing blue lights in the plain car actually led Honolulu police to change their policy so that off-duty or ununiformed officers could no longer pull over drivers using an unmarked car. And when an officer's name leaked, a driver came forward and reported that the same officer had pulled her over using flashing blue grill lights in an unmarked car.
So the officer that potential witness is talking, well, I guess not even witness, but the person who says that they were pulled over by a police officer whose name was leaked, did she say that anything was suspicious other than just being pulled over in an unmarked car? Or was it just that the unmarked car struck her as weird or odd? Which, how weird is it, right? I think that's pretty common.
Right. So the officer that was in question from the leak, his address was actually close by to the scene, and he had a sexual harassment claim against him from like a trainee that had been riding along with him.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah. So, and I also just want to point out that in sources that I read from earlier on, like more like in the 80s and the 90s, they actually do say the officer's names. And then where I found this information, they just said like an officer, his name had leaked. So I'm just like being careful with like when I say his name, because I'm not sure if it's the same officer. I'd imagine so, but I don't want to like pin any alleged crime on anyone. So I just want to keep that, make that clear.
Well, and one thing you said too that kind of strikes me, and I know I talked about this last week, always talking about how a lot of these cases seem really familiar, but when we talked about our very, very first episode, when we went over the Ava Blanco case, the person who ended up being her murderer had actually lived very close to where she was murdered as well. And I think in a lot of cases, you tend to find that the person who's guilty, they do things close to home, which you would think the complete opposite, but it seems to be more common than you might expect.
Definitely. So yeah, it wasn't looking good for him that his home address was like near the scene from where the car was last seen and then where she was found. But even worse for this officer, so now this would be a source that does say the person's name. So the Honolulu Star newspaper reported that the cashier from Lisa's grocery run saw an officer pull over Lisa. This officer was Tommy Byrne. And when the police dogs went to his car to sniff for evidence, they were alerted to his trunk.
Well, that's not suspicious at all.
Right. So as I'm going to continue with the timeline, you're going to see the holes that begin to form in the investigation. And Morgan, we'll get back to like who saw, besides the grocer, like who saw her getting pulled over and stuff like that. So as you can imagine, an investigation with a police officer as a main suspect could possibly have holes, as if they were covering up for their own. So this kind of didn't strike me as like surprising. But in my research following sources from the following weeks, there was so much going on, it seemed like, but little getting done, that it actually almost became hard to follow. And I mean, by all accounts, it seemed that the department wanted the case solved, especially because they had a police dog sniff one of their own's vehicle. I feel like police officers, it's like a brotherhood. They would never turn on another one. And here they actually have such a strong suspicion that they brought the police dogs in to sniff out the trunks of their own cars.
They also, maybe because people are accusing them, maybe it just wasn't on their radar at all that one of their own could have done it. So maybe they were initially just doing that to clear their names. And then when something came up, they were like, oh, shoot.
Yeah, that's true, too. Like trying to immediately like be the person that's like, yeah, sure, come into my home, or like, sure, I'll tell you where I was that night. And then meanwhile, like now they're the one who did it, and like it's all eyes on them. So like I said, they really wanted the case solved and closed, to the point where they even had a police officer who was in the area at the time undergo hypnosis to see if it would jog his memory.
Does hypnosis ever work?
I am not sure, but the officer...
I don't know. I feel like you hear about it in a lot of older cases where they try hypnosis, but I don't... Has it ever worked? I mean, maybe this might be a deep dive that we have to do. Hypnosis and true crime. That'll be one of our future episodes. But it's... Yeah, I just... And if it does work, how reliable could that really be, or how well would that hold up in court?
Right. So that's not going to, the hypnosis is not what it's going to bring us to the break in the case. I'm sure you would have imagined that. He was direct, like I said, it was like a torrential downpour, which I think is like pretty common for them in their winter season. So he was out there directing traffic, and under the assumption that he had to have seen something, they did the hypnosis, and he's like, I do not remember. Like, I don't know. So about a year and a half later, after Lisa's body was found, in May 1983, the family grew frustrated and hired outside entities to begin handling the case as well as suing the city for negligence. The family hired an attorney, Roy Chang, to begin assisting with the lawsuit against the city. And Roy Chang hired a cop turned private investigator, Bert Corneal, to begin re-examining the evidence. Ironically enough, at the time of Lisa's body being recovered, Corneal was in the Honolulu Police Department and had temporarily been in charge of the homicide detail, so he was more than familiar. It was Corneal who begins to not only debunk a rogue cop theory, but also show everything the Honolulu Police Department did not do to ensure the case was solved. Corneal uncovered that some of the investigation was just careless. We just went over how the grocery store cashier gave a witness account that she saw Al get pulled over after leaving the store. However, the same article did not account for what I'm about to say, so I'm not sure if it's a Corneal discovery or just journalism lacking the facts. But Corneal brought to light that the reason Al didn't have her license on her was because she had to write a check at the store. So remember checkbooks? You would have to fill it out and show your ID to show that you're not writing a bad check. So she had to show her ID and did so without taking it back from the store clerk and left the store without the license.
Oh, so the license was in the store then. So that the whole missing license theory, because the cop pulled her over and saw it, that goes out the window now. Right.
So now we're like, originally we might have been like, okay, she got pulled over, thinks it's either literally a police officer or someone impersonating. She rolls down her window and hands over her license. And then obviously the crime ensued and she never got it back. But now Corneal discovers that the store clerk had it all along because she forgot it.
Got it.
So it's like, why didn't we hear about that from the beginning? So I found it odd that the source would report on a witness account but skip over a chain of custody issue unless it wasn't found out until years later. So again, I'm not sure if that was a Corneal discovery or something they just didn't report on, but they knew. The next thing that Corneal unveils that can debunk that a real cop likely pulled over Al is an account from the security guard at the complex where Lisa and her boyfriend Doug Holmes had dinner. This guard reported that before the couple went their separate ways that night, they were seen arguing in the parking lot area. In addition to sources reporting the night ended earlier than usual, it was also reported that Doug had scratches on his face. And I just want to remind listeners, too, that Doug is the one that found her car, and we all know about husbands and lovers inserting themselves into the investigation. Now, let me frustrate you with this witness account even more. The Honolulu Police Department, or HPD, did not even contact the guard until Corneal prompted the police to this account.
So you're saying that Honolulu police didn't speak to anyone at the last reported location where Lisa was seen alive? Am I understanding that right?
You're correct. So I was not sure why the private investigator is the first one to truly be retracing her footsteps over a year and a half later.
So the private investigator went to the apartment complex and interviewed people there, and that's how we found this witness? Or did the police department already have the witness and just kind of not question him or talk to him further?
No, the private investigator was the first one to truly be retracing her footsteps over a year and a half later. So he's the one.
That's unbelievable.
Right? So he, Corneal, actually brought this witness account to HPD's attention. So we've repeated time and time again that, and I'm sure all our listeners know this, this is like basic true crime, is that the first 24 hours is the most important. So the fact that the witnesses are just being contacted by HPD a year and a half later was like mind-boggling to me and disappointing.
And at that time, too, their memory is fading. Like, how are they supposed to remember what they saw a year and a half ago?
Exactly.
You know, don't they say that witness accounts are not reliable, like, 3 days later or something super short like that?
I mean, they're already unreliable like the same day. So, I mean, imagine a year. I mean, you ask me what I did a year ago today, I have no clue. I don't know who I saw. I don't even know where I was, you know? So it's crazy.
Yeah. So either the security guard just gave like a super basic account, like I remember it, or the argument was like severe enough that he remembers it a year and a half later. We could look at it that way, too. And he saw this dog with scratches on his face. So was it that it was severe enough that he just remembers a year and a half later, like stark memory, or did he just provide like the bare bones of the account?
I wonder, too, like, why didn't he contact the police? Assuming if he remembers this because he's like, oh, yeah, this is the girl that they just found. And maybe that's why he remembers it. Why didn't he reach out to the police?
Yeah. So we're actually going to get to a witness that ran into the problem I'm about to say. But there was witness, like some witnesses said that, hey, you know, we went to HPD and we're telling them that, you know, we saw this or we saw that. And they just never would reach back out to them. That said, there was another witness account in all this, a newspaper delivery woman, Charlotte Kamaka, who reported some oddities from that night as well, and potentially two run-ins with our suspect. Kamaka reported to HPD that she had seen suspicious behavior where Al's body was found. She reported that she informed police of her accounts and left them with her contact information, but they never reached out. She actually found herself following up with them. Are there any updates? Are you still interested in my account? And they just would never get back to her. So like basically what Morgan was just asking. Kamaka later was able to testify her account, which is that on her paper route at about 2:30 a.m., she saw a blue car being driven with a female passenger whose head was down. And when the car made the turn, the head just stayed down, moving loosely. So I know we're not a visual podcast, but if you can envision, she looks like she's kind of sleeping, but like, it's like her head was like bobbling down. Later on, she saw the same car again when it made a turnaround in the lookout area. But this time the driver was alone and he just like stared at her before he pulled off. They never said if she knew of like the tag numbers. They never said like if she got a good look at his face. I mean, I'd imagine it's 2:30 in the morning and there's like a torrential downpour. So maybe she just didn't get a good look. But that's something that they actually never mentioned. So from the blue car account, I do want to share something that I saw in a news coverage that I have watched. And when the anchor discusses the argument and activity at the parking garage, they pan to a photo of a blue sedan. Now, Lisa's car is a brown Toyota. So I'm wondering if the blue car from their footage is Doug's and also the same car that Kamaka saw during her paper route. And now I know what you're thinking from the car footage. That I chose another case where the boyfriend spirals, admits to the crime, goes to prison, and the community can breathe that a criminal is off the streets. That is wrong. So I looked at Doug Holmes more closely. And when I look at him, I realize I need to introduce you to another key player in what seems to be the pitfalls of this investigation. And that is Nelson Lum, a lead homicide detective on the case at the time. And Lum admitted on record that HPD spent 3 years pursuing an innocent man, and he is no longer convinced that the suspect is a police officer or even a city employee. So at this point, Tommy Byrne from earlier in the show with the canine dogs is off the hook. He also tried to discredit Kamaka's account from her newspaper route because he reported that her story kept changing. But I think the worst of everything with Lum is his interviews and takes on Doug Holmes. You see, Holmes was given 2 lie detector tests, and he failed both. And when Lum spoke to him, he asked him, what's going on that you failed the tests? And Holmes attributed it to overall guilt for not driving Lisa home in the rain, as he knew she was an inexperienced driver. Lum also went on to say that, and you won't believe this, that simply put, he was just satisfied with Holmes' story. Lum reported that since there was no money, baby, or a cheating jealousy thing going on, he couldn't pin a motive on Holmes.
Are you kidding me? That's insane.
I know. Like, sometimes, like, it's just random. Like, people lose it and they hurt someone. You don't need a money scandal or baby or cheating to be going on to snap. And that's literally how the newspaper or the news channel reported. Like, he was satisfied with Holmes' story.
I mean, you can even say the same thing about domestic violence. I mean, just where there's domestic violence, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's monetary issues or children involved or cheating. Sometimes it's just people are shitty people. That's just the way it is, you know?
I was, when I heard that he was satisfied with his story and he just can't pin a motive, I was like, I know.
That's nuts.
So yeah, we pretty much all are in agreement that it's not ever that simple. But Holmes reported to Lum that he actually wanted to end the relationship as he felt they were going different directions. But still, Lum saw nothing there. So you see someone that wants to end a relationship and maybe they don't have these scandalous motives, but they have a simple one that they want to end it. But you don't see, again, any motive with that. Like, as of now, we have Holmes with scratches on his face, an argument at the site where the victim was last seen alive, a matching car, at least by my accounts from, like I said, matching the news footage to Kamaka's account, and two failed lie detector tests. But no arrests. Holmes was never arrested. Remember the Honolulu coroner reported that they could not determine the cause of death? Well, in 1983, the body was exhumed and brought to a medical examiner in Los Angeles for a second autopsy. And again, we are disappointed because the only thing that they could determine was that she did not die of natural causes, even after examining the jaw and the skull. So it kind of felt to me like exhuming her body, which is very sensitive to some people, was almost pointless because obviously when you find someone naked in the woods, they probably didn't die from natural causes. Interestingly, Hawaii News Now interviewed a forensic anthropologist who reported that you can tell a great deal from the neck up, but an amateur could easily miss something. And this Hawaii News Now special was actually in 2019. So this is an anthropologist that is speaking from some of the most recent technology, recent education, and so on. So it's interesting that the anthropologists would even mention an amateur because, ironically enough, it did not seem that the city handled Lisa's body with care for the first round of autopsy at all. Her body was never washed. It was buried in the police body bag with dirt and leaves inside. Now, of course, I mentioned the article or the video was from 2019, so this anthropologist is hopeful that with new technology, they'd be able to take a look at Lisa's body and uncover more of what may have happened that night. But are you ready for this one? Authorities don't know what happened to Lisa's skull and jaw after the autopsy in LA. The police say that the LA medical examiner has the remains, but the medical examiner reports that they were returned with the body in casket. Come on!
So her entire skull is missing.
They talk about how the ME, medical examiner, is like, no, I gave it back with the full body and the casket. And now the police are saying that, no, the ME still has those parts.
How? I mean, like, I really don't want to be like, I'm not trying to be insensitive, but like, how do you misplace a skull?
You know, when you research things, you rewind them like 20 different times. Like, let's make sure we get everything. And I was like, okay, am I hearing this right? I'm reading the transcription. Am I reading this right? Like, come on. It's so unfortunate that the only way to really find out is it in the casket with her body is to exhume her again, which again is like so traumatic for her family because they've already done it once and got almost no answers.
So it is possible that it was buried again. So it's either, okay, right. Yeah, so it was misplaced or buried again are the two options.
Right, so So I just want to ask you guys, like, what are your theories on the case?
Can I also just petition to call this thrilleries instead of theories?
It rolls off the tongue.
The thrilogy. All right, Morgan, I'll let you share your thoughts first on this one.
The boyfriend, right? Like, he has scratches on his face, arguing. Yeah. Like, this kind of, and, you know, we always say the first person that we look at is the significant other, and he doesn't have an alibi. We don't have any reason to believe it wasn't him, except for his word, which he lied. I'm not satisfied by it, and the lie detector wasn't. So, yeah, that's who I think it is.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to agree. And I actually think that in an alternate universe where this case actually had the time, the dedication, and the care that it should have had, I think I agree with you. I think it probably would have been him. He probably would have been the one who was arrested because obviously there's a lack of evidence, right? But is there a lack of evidence because there's actually a lack of evidence, like the case that we were talking about last week, how there was just nothing? Or is there a lack of evidence because they never even looked for it? I mean, we saw that it wasn't taken, like this entire case wasn't treated how it should have been treated, at least from what we're seeing on the outside. So I think if it would have been, you know, if there would have been some priority there or just some extra care with it.
All right.
Or care at all. Like, this is crazy.
Yeah. It's just nuts. I mean, even going as far as like her being exhumed and people not even knowing where her skull is, like, I'm still stuck on that. It's just unbelievable. Like, even after this case was deemed unsolved or whatever the case is.
Yeah, it's like, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that like some physical evidence most likely washed away. You know, it was like a torrential, like unsafe downpour. Course.
We saw that with the Ava case too. Like, not to keep going back to it, but remember how it was raining the night she went missing as well. So it was harder to find.
Exactly. So it's like, all right, I'll give them a benefit of the doubt on that. But with like all the witness accounts, like, you didn't reach out to the security guard and now you're trying to discredit one of the most solid witnesses that you had, which was the newspaper woman who like literally saw the potential suspect with a female in his car that looked unconscious. Just, yeah, the care, the losing of the body parts potentially was just like, what is going on?
I have a quick question because I'm trying to think like if we have any other real suspects here. I know that the police, like foul play through the police department was ruled out, but whatever happened to the trunk, like, didn't the police dog smell something?
That's a good question.
Yeah. In the trunk, like, do we have any information on why they were alerted or and like how they were cleared from that? Like, I'm just confused.
So no, they did not ever go back to the trunk. They didn't say like what kind of activity that the dog could have been alerted to. Like, I don't know, you know, some dogs sniff out like the body, some dogs sniff out drugs, whatever. So they never even said what that was, and they just never carried on.
It's actually funny after you mentioned that, because when we were originally talking about that, I was wondering, well, why would a dog alert to the trunk? But I'm just thinking, if, you know, let's say that that police car had been used for like a drug bust or something.
Right. Or holding evidence. I
mean, the police officers have to take the drugs to the police station somehow. Right. And they probably more likely than not put it in the trunk. So I'm almost wondering if maybe the dog that was brought out alerted to maybe like the smell of drugs or something from a previous case, or, you know, whatever the case
might
be. Right,
or like other evidence irrelevant to. Yeah. And also just like worth noting quickly, like and again, I think this is why Burns' name is mentioned early on, like I said, in the 80s and 90s accounts, but like now in 2019, 2020, not at all. It's actually because, well, I believe to be because that officer began a lawsuit against the city because he alleged that like it ruined his career and his life that they pinned this on him. The case did wind up getting dismissed, but I'd imagine that's why a lot of like journalists do tread lightly around saying that.
Sure.
And I guess that's also why like they probably didn't, another reason they may not have pursued the drunk, because they had maybe a shaky foundation and already saw that they could be in trouble trying to pin this on this officer. I mean, he was suspicious, his address and, you know, driving around with a trainee with the sexual harassment, but, you know, he might just be a creep.
Right. And if I'm choosing between the police officer and the boyfriend with the scratches on his face, I'm going with the boyfriend.
Yeah, like, I think that's fair to say.
Pretty much like once we realize, I feel like that the grocer had her ID or her license, it was like the pulling over theory was pretty much debunked. I mean, you can get pulled over without your license, of course, but like.
Well, not only that, too, but I feel like, and I'm sure there are cases out there that it's happened, but I just feel like it'd be so risky for an on-duty police officer to try anything. You know, if he was off duty or something, maybe I would understand it, you know, abuse of power or something along those lines. But yeah,
right.
I think maybe what happened with him is, I think there's a lot of what we would consider evidence, but it's not really evidence. It's just some really weird things all kind of coming together, a bunch of coincidences, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So, and then something I kept thinking to myself too, but you know, you don't really find like a shred of information on it, is I'm wondering, like, did Holmes have family in Honolulu Police Department or a near police department? Because it just seems that HPD's Detective Lum like went above and beyond to make sure he never went too far saying anything incriminating.
Well, I feel like in Hawaii, it's such a small place. And I know Honolulu is one of their biggest cities, but I feel like it might even be one of those cases like everyone knows everyone type of thing. Like,
yeah,
even if they weren't family members, like the police officer could have just as easily known him really well and been like, oh, there's no way it's him. So let me help him.
Yeah. They also highlighted that Holmes felt that he was so much more education oriented than Al was, and that he was gonna, you know, he was just doing more with his schooling, and that's part of why they were going on different paths. And it kind of reminded me in a way of how, of like the Brock Turner case. And I know this is not like directly like a sexual assault or anything that we know of, because everything is gone, washed away. But it was like, you know, a young man, he has a future. He's saying he's education oriented, and, you know, maybe the Department of Men, you know, again, this was in 82, who knows what type of misogyny, don't want to see a future that's of his that's tainted by this crime. So that's kind of what I thought of as well. Could be a case that they know he did it and they just brushing it under the rug to not ruin two lives. So now that we have our theories, I just want to bring up one more potential theory. And this may be another episode, but from 1985 to 1986, Honolulu dealt with a serial strangler and rapist who was coined the Honolulu Strangler. And while this theoretically began 3 years after Lisa was found murdered, could it have been that it was when they were just starting to dabble in murder in 1982? After all, we have no DNA evidence to know if it was sexual assault or strangulation was involved, but it cannot entirely be ruled out. As recently as 2019, Hawaii News Now reported that unfortunately, both Lisa's parents have passed away, as well as a security guard and the paper delivery woman. However, some of the officers on the case are still alive, and one reports he would be willing to give a testimony for Lisa's case if it was ever brought to court again. Lisa's sisters long for an answer about what happened to Lisa that January night. Holmes, he reportedly moved to Australia and did not provide Hawaiian News Now much of any comment besides that Lisa deserves justice and he's happy that the HPD now has a cold case squad. The case remains cold to this day and no one has ever been punished for what happened to Lisa. The Honolulu Police Department does have a page for their cold cases dating back to 1965, but interestingly enough, Lisa's name is nowhere to be found.
Okay, based on that, I'm really starting to think, like, he knows someone in the force. Like, why at every single turn, even now, like, her skull was lost and now she's not even listed on this website.
Right, and he moved to Australia.
Yep.
To top it off. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is suspicious, and I didn't really, until you said that about her name not being listed anywhere in their cold case files, yeah, there's something off about that. I don't know. That doesn't feel right.
They could have just listed her and not even actively pursued it, but they're not even listing it.
Yeah, because like at the end of the episode today, I was going to be like, you know, hey, I know this case is really old, but if you have any information, blah, blah. So I was like, let me just double check that as of 2021, it's like still a cold case. And it's nowhere on their website. And I was like, okay, maybe the technology that they're listing the cases didn't go back to 1982. So I was like, let me just try like the earliest year they have listed on their drop-down menu, which was 1965. They have people listed for 1965. Yeah. And still nothing for 1982. I checked 1983. I searched her name in the search bar. Nothing. So,
and I mean, realistically speaking, 1982 is not, I mean, it's really not that old, you know, in the grand scheme of things.
Right. Like in terms of listing a case, right. Like, that's nothing right. Crazy. So.
Yeah, that's too bad. All I, you know, I made a lot of comparisons to the Ava case during this episode. And all I can say is I really hope that someday Lisa's case ends up being our future Ava case and we find out what happened.
Right. Like some closure. So now I just want to remind everyone we are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and we would love for you to share your theories there with us. What do you think happened to Lisa Au? Thank you, everyone, for listening and joining us today. And you can find all photos and sources for this case on our website, thrillogypodcast.com.
We release new episodes every Monday, and each week we release two clues leading up to the release of our next episode. The first clue is a familiar case with a not-so-familiar name. Be sure to check out our Instagram for the second clue later this week.
I want to give a special shout out to @AllieMiller and @LouisFit on Instagram for trying to guess the topic of today's episode, even if they weren't quite correct. We love interacting with you guys on social media, so please keep the guesses coming.
I do want to point out, though, that Allie Miller actually guessed the Honolulu Strangler, so that's the closest guess that we've had from the episodes. So good job.
That's true.
Thanks again for listening, and as always, you can keep up with all things Thrillogy on social media at Thrillogy Pod and make story requests on thrillogypodcast.com.